Are we on? Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the House Water Committee meeting, the 1st of April. I hope after a very productive morning that that wasn't an April Fool's presentation we were getting, Director Ball. Welcome to our House Water Committee, and we're going to open the hearing with, or not the hearing, but the public meeting with a presentation, a little bit of the Coastal Coho, the Oregon Plan in action. And I think Director Ball has some, I suppose for many of you it's not new news, but still good news about what we've done there and what's taking place, and what maybe the prospects are, and how a little bit maybe about the hatchery that is being developed out here in the LC watershed is going to be of benefit to us in the future. So without wasting any time, Lindsay, we would probably proceed, but maybe a need to introduce the members of the legislature that are here. We have Representative Schaffler from the Clackamas area, Representative Galto from the Salem area, Representative Brown from more or less this area. and Representative Dingfelder from, what's that city? The Portland area.
And Maywood Park.
What?
And I represent two cities, also Maywood Park.
Okay. And I am State Representative Bob Jensen from Pendleton, and have had the extremely good fortune of chairing the Water Committee now for, the Water Committee or the SR2 Committee now for three sessions. And it is an absolute privilege and delight for me to be here with you and to be in your community. And we hope to hear from all of you who have anything or wish to say anything this afternoon. We're making a substantial effort, I think, in the state, and as I've said in relationship to a number of things, the effort really is not an effort on the part of the state. It's an effort that is demonstrated on being a part of the people of the state. Any successes we are enjoying in the recovery of this icon of Oregon's is compliments of you, the people, more than us, the government, or us, the agency, if you wish. No disrespect intended, Director Ball, with that statement. So with that, if I could introduce, for those of you who don't know him, Director Ball, and he will proceed through his presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In 1997, the Oregon legislature implemented and funded the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And, Chair Jensen, I share with you the same feelings about the Oregon Plan. The Oregon Plan cannot be found in any one agency, nor can the Oregon Plan be found in a collection of agencies. It is found collectively in the coordinated contribution of all government entities in partnership with the public and our land-based industries. And additionally to that, the cooperative-collaborative partnership is what will sustain the Oregon Plan, not mandated regulatory function. The spirit is through the cooperative, collaborative process that was developed in 1997, and I feel that that is what the spirit is of Oregon. Now, the specific statutory authority that gives Department of Fish and Wildlife the authority to manage its wildlife is found in 496 through 513 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife shall manage to prevent serious depletion of any indigenous species and to provide the optimum recreational and aesthetic benefits for present and future generations of this state. And another highlight of this statute was passed by the Water Committee during the last session, and that is a definition of recovery, something which our federal counterparts are still searching an answer for. It is defined by means that a proportion of the constituent populations of a naturally produced native fish belonging to a listed unit are sufficiently abundant, productive, and diverse in life histories and distributions such that the listed unit as a whole is likely to be self-sustaining in the foreseeable future. That is was a landmark decision, in my estimation, by the legislature when it was developed by the Salmon Committee and then delivered to us as a statute. Conservation and fish management is the purpose and responsibility of ODFW, and what the Oregon Plan has brought to the table is a process for a coordinated, collaborative response by all parties. The Oregon Plan has been a high priority for this agency ever since I became director. We have made significant progress on this priority, actively integrating the Oregon Plan into the culture and operation of the agency throughout the state. One key measure of success, and I think this is one that we cannot ever turn our back on, is that we need to avoid any further listings of species on the endangered species list. And those that are on the list, we need to get off the list. Oregon is aggressively moving forward with actions and assessments of our populations of fish and wildlife necessary to meet this challenge. Now, we briefed the committee on the Coastal Coho Project last month, which was a good example of the Oregon Plan in action with results. To summarize some of the draft results, once again to illustrate leadership in the Oregon Plan, I'll bring the committee and members of the audience to the point where the Coastal Coho Evolutionary Significant Unit has passed the minimum viability criteria as identified by our state fisheries scientists. In other words, our proposal to NOAA Fisheries and the federal government is that we have sufficient viability in our coho population that it warrants consideration for a no-list decision by the Department of Commerce. We feel that point, at this point in time, a no-list decision of the coastal coho illustrates the success story of the Oregon Plan. Historic land and water and fish management activities associated with the coho decline have been stopped. All of our represented land-based industries, some of who are on the tour and some who are here in the audience today, have all been a party to that success. Conservation efforts have been addressed with respect to the primary harvest and hatchery-related threats to minimum ESU viability. In the slideshow I'm going to show you in a minute, you will see how we have changed some of the harvest and hatchery regimens and routines that we've practiced in past years to where they are not a hindrance to the fish population today. We also feel that we have sufficient monitoring in place so that if we find that the fish is starting to slip, we can take immediate action in order to halt the factor causing the decline of the fishery. Opportunities to strengthen the ESU have been identified. As we have identified the viability criteria, we've noted weaknesses in the ESU with the coho, and we can make those adjustments in our management programs to emphasize more stringent management in some areas versus those areas where the population is doing much better. As discussed with the committee last month, we are currently reviewing comments on our draft assessment and anticipate submitting a final report to NOAA Fisheries on coastal coho by the end of this month. In addition to completing a full conservation plan for coastal coho by the end of this year, we are pleased to be able to shift emphasis to other areas of the state. Our focus will start on lower Columbia River coho and mid-Columbia steelhead, one species, mid-Columbia River steelhead, is listed. Lower Columbia River coho is a candidate for listing by the federal government. We would then move into the Willamette and Snake River systems at that time. Let's take a look at some of the things we've done on coastal coho. Please look at the screen over on your right or your left as committee members. Let's take a look at distribution and abundance of coho along the Oregon coast. This is from Cape Blanco to the mouth of the Columbia River. In 1998, we had a spawner abundance of 30,000 fish. And in the year 2003, we had 222,000 spawner abundance in coastal coho. And quite honestly, members of the committee, this is what really forced us to take a real hard look at coastal coho and get other people on board with us to ask the question, is the fish a candidate for listing or should it come off the list? And the viability criteria that staff at ODFW went through, we have determined that the fish is a candidate for consideration not to be listed in the state of Oregon. Now, to describe this for the audience, the members of the committee have seen this, but to describe it for the audience, in 1998, where you see all the red, that's where we had populations that were below management objective. The blue, or the purple, depending upon how you evaluate your color scheme, the blue is where we had adequate populations to meet the management objectives of those different watersheds. And you'll see that as you move from 1998 to 2003, the range was expanded and the density of numbers expanded as well. And that brought us to the conclusion that we could look at this fish for taking it off the list. One of the things that we adjusted, and I mentioned to the committee that we had adjusted some things with respect to harvest. If you take a look at the lower graph, at the blue bar versus the yellow bar, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, 80s, and 90s, the yellow bar was the spawner escapement of coho to the spawning grounds. If you take a look at 0103, the yellow bar indicates the spawners that made it back to the spawning grounds to spawn, and they exceed those numbers from 1950 to present. So I think our harvest regime that we have currently on ocean and inland fisheries with respect to coho is working for us. We have good spawner survival, much better than what we had in past years. The graph at the top, many of you noticed in the sport fisheries today, the fall Chinook has become an item of interest because it is an abundant number up and down our coastal watersheds. And Chinook spawners have increased proportionately. When we evaluated the coastal coho, the graph and map on the left-hand side indicates that all populations have passed in our ESU monitoring, and therefore we feel that the ESU itself should pass for a no-list decision. Taking a look at monitoring strategies from the reader board, expenditures related to coho monitoring, you'll see that we have spent a total of $15.9 million from 97 through 2003 on monitoring our coho. And monitoring is what has delivered us the information for us to go forward to NOAA Fisheries and ask for a no-list decision on this species. Wild coho abundance. I showed you this slide just to illustrate how many sites that we have on coastal coho in the northern part of the state where we monitor that fishery. Restoration funding on habitat from 97 to 2003 is $107 million. If you look at the Fife chart down the lower right-hand corner, you're going to see it's about one-third shared between federal, state, and private ownership. One-third of those dollars, better than $30 million, has been paid by private landowners, and a lot of that in the coastal community has been private timberlands. And I also want to mention, if you take a look at where coastal coho inhabit, a lot of that is in our private timber and agricultural lands. So without our private partners in those two land-based industries, we would not fare as well as what we have today without their cooperation. OEB grants totaled $22 million for acquisition, assessment, council support, education, monitoring, and restoration being the most of that, which is habitat. As an example, Representative Brown, this is your watershed over near where you live.
It's over the hill.
Yep, it's the Aquinnah. These are sites where we have restored habitat that has been damaged over time. And I might add, Representative, the coho fish population in Aquinnah, if it meets its management objectives this year, as we anticipate it will, the local biologists will advocate for a harvest of coho in this system once they return as spawners. It would probably follow something similar to silk coos and tachinich, which would be one fish per day, five per year on wild coho. Statewide, so you can get a picture of how we monitor and how we have restoration projects throughout the state of Oregon. Go from southeast to northwest, southwest to northeast. You see a lot of restoration projects throughout Oregon funded through Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Harvest rates, if you look in the ocean compared to the 70s and 80s, we've dropped the harvest rate considerably, both in the ocean and in the river. And that illustrates active management on behalf of the department in controlling that fishery. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that Oregon is at a pivotal time in its history to be a strong leader in helping move beyond the need for federal and state ESA protections. The ingredients are in our hands. The Oregon Plan, the Native Fish Conservation Policy, and Fish Hatchery Management Policy, internally in this agency and externally with the Oregon Plan, are all policies that are putting us in a position to manage a fishery in a sustained manner. We have Measure 66 funding, federal funding through the Pacific Salmon Fund, and the state wildlife grants as well. We have clarification of the definition of recovery through our legislative assembly, and we have extensive monitoring programs, as I have illustrated on the board. We have the scientific expertise to develop viability criteria to propose to the U.S. government that fish should come off the list. And as the tour demonstrated today, we have a facility being built for research to answer much-needed questions. And most of all, we have a supportive and involved public with people from the private land-based industries and people who are interested in general about their fisheries resource here to help us. Mr. Chair, I think we've got a winner.
Thank you. Commissioner, Director Ball, just get the hopefully. I'm kind of used to referring to him as Captain Ball, and that shows both of our dates both of us a little bit, I guess, when I do that. Are there any questions or observations for Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Director, is there any way to weight what the changing in ocean conditions had to do with the recovery? And then you made the statement that you would be, if conditions changed where the coho could possibly be threatened again, if it was from ocean conditions, what can you do to
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown. Ocean conditions play a large part in anadromous fish success from juvenile to adult. No question about that. The answer to that question is multifaceted. The one thing that we observed when we were in a downturn with respect to coho salmon, in the 90s particularly, was that we saw those fish retreat to some core habitat areas around the state. And they were able to survive in those isolated core habitat areas that were particularly conducive to their needs. We've got those sites identified. We know what needs the fish have at those certain times of their life cycle. So it's important that we protect that, those core areas, and enhance other areas so that that fish can find core habitat areas in other watersheds as it did when it shrank down, if you recall from the graph I showed earlier, to where the red was showing, more red was showing than blue. If we can create more of those kinds of core habitat areas in those typical red areas, then that fish over time will sustain itself longer and better in those watersheds that showed up red on the mapping that I put up in front of you. Now, how do we get around the ocean condition? There's no way we can control that. But I do know one thing. I can't get fish back if I can't get fish to the ocean. And so it's still incumbent upon us to be very mindful of the habitat needs. But I think we also have to recognize one thing, too, which I think some people have kind of overlooked. Under our current land use practices, this fish, once it was given an adequate ocean condition, it demonstrated that it was very resilient. Now, the ocean conditions that we experienced in the 90s were unprecedented over the last 50 years that we have accurately recorded ocean conditions. How often that may occur is a question that is yet to be answered. If it doesn't happen in the next 50 years or even the next 100 years, I think you're going to find that the fish will probably sustain itself without any trouble. But my point being, if we have the monitoring in place that we do today, so we can monitor the trend in that population as to what that fish is doing, we would have the ability to implement management measures that would give it more protection. And that's why it's so essential that we continue our monitoring and continue our habitat work in those areas where the fish has demonstrated it could use the habitat if it was available to it. Quite frankly, what we discovered in our viability criteria, the North Coast species of the coastal coho is in more need of habitat work than the central or southern part of its range. And so one of the things that we've told the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, it might be necessary for us to invest our money in the northern coast to help habitat project to fund habitat projects in that area to give the fish a boost, where it is in other watersheds it's demonstrated that it's been holding its own. And I think that's the best thing that we can do for the fish so we can keep out of a listing a decision in the future, or even a recommendation.
Follow up. Is the work on that's been done on the habitat, is that something it ever comes to an end, or it's a continual process? That there's always going to be work to be done. So.
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, I think there's always going to be work to be done on habitat. I don't think you're going to get away from that. That's just the nature of the beast, particularly when we have industries that can adversely impact the fish. In addition to that, I think it's important to note we're going to learn more about this fish, about what the fish needs in the future. And this is an evolving science, and as we learn, we may discover that we are doing some things wrong today. And that's one of the things that the Hatchery Research Center is going to tell us. And if we can get out ahead of those harms to the environment before they become catastrophic, That's going to be to our advantage as a society and also to the fish's advantage.
One more?
Oh.
Do you ever have any concern that to open up the streams to harvesting again, that it might be too soon?
That's going to be my question. Good question.
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, I feel that with the monitoring program that we have in place and the ability we have, and I have as a director, to close a fishery if we feel that it is harvesting too many fish, I can close that by the stroke of a pen. And with our monitoring that we have in place, we can find out, we can monitor that to the point where we can see that population starting to slip. I feel very comfortable where we are today. Now, let me back up a little bit. I wasn't a few years ago. I think we over-harvested our fish in some respects, and in some populations, in some instances, we harvested 92% of the coho population. We routinely harvested 70%+ of the population. And I think by our monitoring programs today, we recognize that harvest measures below that, down in the 30-40% range, will allow us a sustainable spawner population in our watersheds on the Oregon coast. I feel comfortable today. If you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I would have told you I was very uncomfortable. But I am I am comfortable today. I'm not worried.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Ball. Before you run off and leave, I think I would like to express my appreciation for the work that Lindsay has done in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I know that at times he's come to my office somewhat frustrated with the world and what was going on, but even at that, with a pretty positive, upbeat way. I, for one, appreciate the leadership that you have shown for us and the efforts that the department has gone to in the last five, 6 years. And so a good deal of the success things that we're looking at can be attributed to your work and the work of the people in the department. So my appreciation to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. One comment. I can't do much by myself. I've had a lot of help.
Understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a number of folks who have signed up to witness, talk to us today, express their concerns, opinions, and basically, if we can get you to confine your comments to about a 5-minute period, I think we can get through everybody without any real difficulty. So, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to call you up three people at a time, if I could. And that way we can get through and, you know, kind of have a little more orderly panel than having each person come and go and more time wasted, I guess, with it. So with that, I have Wayne, is it Giese, Andy Landforts, and Jeff Light to start with. And if you would, in the order that we read your names.
Chairman Jensen and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Giese, and I represent Hall Oaks Lumber Company. And I might give you a little of my history. You might get a little tickle out of this. I served in the legislature 50 years ago, the first term, this year. And we were paid $50 a month, and I really worked hard at that job. But what hurts badly, a lot of people thought we were overpaid.
I still think that.
Yeah.
The Hatchery Research Center, HRC, at Fall Creek is one of a kind, state-of-the-art facility, an important part of Oregon's efforts to delist and in the future to keep coho off the endangered species list. Thanks to the wisdom of the last legislature and the governor, the HRC was authorized. HRC is designed to replicate natural conditions in Oregon streams and rivers. It will be supervised and operated by fishery scientists under Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and Oregon State University. Management is a key to continued viable populations of coho and steelhead. The Hatchery Research Center will dispel many of the myths regarding these salmonids and lay the groundwork to utilize on-the-ground science to best manage fisheries. This science will stand the most rigid peer review. The late Dr. Jim Lannan, a noted fishery biologist and geneticist, stated, a minimum of 15-year research program would supply the scientific answers to best manage the fisheries. Everyone here knows the results of science in the increased production of wheat, corn, soybean, beef, and poultry, to name a few. Without this scientific progress, many people would be starving in the world today. Believe me, the same is needed in the management of the fisheries, not only for the sportsmen, but for one component of our food supply. Your continued support of the HRC is very important to Oregon's economy, as well as the benefits to others in the world. In addition, this science will eliminate the need for more land use regulations under the Endangered Species Act. And I thank you for this opportunity to express our views.
Thank you very much for your comments and testimony, Wayne. Before we move on to Andy, I'm not sure that everyone understood that there was a sign-up sheet if you wanted to talk today. If you didn't get signed up, I think there's still a sheet up there. Would you please sign in so that we can do that? And at this point, then, moving on to Andy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate today having the administrators and people here in the decision-making situation. And I would like to represent the fishermen. And in doing that, I would like to tell you how the hatchery production at the Alsea Hatchery has talked to the people of the Alsea Valley. I started fishing here before the hatchery program. And before the hatchery program, I've experienced the frustration of wondering, as I fished with Dr. Bond and Lee Kuhn and Wade and other fishermen, will I ever catch two steelhead a day? To where I advanced to place and after retirement of guiding, where I took people from out of state, I declined to fish, take people in state, because when you take people out of state, you bring real wealth to our state. To a point where people who couldn't thread their fishing rod, tie them up, would limit out on steelhead trout in the river here by 11 o'clock in the morning. I got too cocky. I didn't have the people come until later in the afternoon. The results, with Clock Webb wanted to have 800 females come back to the hatchery before the hatchery program. After the hatchery program was started, we're fishing on the river, but the hatchery didn't talk to us by words. The hatchery talked to us 2 and 3 years after the first introduction of fish. There were fish on the river, and we that were fishing thought, what is going on? We're catching 2 and 3 fish, we're catching fish. As a result, all the land from the hatchery to Missouri Bend is privately owned, and the deeds read that they own the land on the bottom of the river, including the Marauding River. And the Game Commission, the Oregon State Game Commission, at that time, Errol Clare was the fishery biologist here. He came up to me on the river and said, hey, look, Andy, the landowners are wondering what's going on because they're having people go across their land and trampling the bridges down. So the Isaac Walling League said, we'll cooperate with the landowners. Les Dumault from the Oregon State Game Commission came with a little ladder that we could put on the gates. But we made a mistake. What happens is when, Bob, if you'd put up a ladder around the fence and the other landowner didn't, he'd say, hey, you were having conflict. You're encouraging these people. We don't want them here. So let's find out what's going on at the hatchery. So the county agent in Benton County, we got together and we invited the Oregon Fish Commission, which had the facilities where we have been this afternoon down in Fall Creek, the Oregon State Game Commission, the Forest Service, and the BLM, because the BLM owned the land at Missouri Bend. Will you come to a meeting of all the landowners in LC Valley and let's talk about your program? What does the Forest Service want to do? What does the Game Commission want to do? What does the Forest Service, and find out what's going on? As a result of that meeting, which was held over in the high school over here, not here, the Isaac Walton said, Isaac Walton League said, we'll clean up the river every year after the fishing season's over. And there was a lot of cooperation. And so we got understanding. The hatchery told us by results. The hatchery told us of the plan. Doc Webb was talking to us about that plan. Now, today, on the river, we have witnessed a fabulous installation that is aimed at getting at answers. Right now, as we sit here, for over 30 years, there's been work done at Mineral Creek up in Washington, where the stream is half the size of the North Fork, where we measured every fish that went up and every fish that came back. One of the answers you wanted, how many steelhead survive to come back the second time? We were very interested in fishing, about 7%, by the way. Right now, we're at in about 30 years of work on the Washougal River, which has a very unique system. It's like the LC. It's about 45 miles long. And it has a natural dam on it, of which here is a place where they can collect the fish at the bottom and turn the ones unmarked fish above the dam. It's going on the Ethiopian. The Squamish River north of Vancouver, British Columbia, has been on the tube fishery. I hope all you decision makers know what we're talking about when we talk to tube fishery. Let me just tell you quickly. On the 2nd of March this year, when I started fishing, they ended the season on the last day of February, which was a good run of fish over on the selects, big ones. Now they moved to the 31st. Today is the first day we're moving into authorizing fishing on the LC through the month of April. One of the things that's happening is all the hatchery programs have been aimed at production because the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife has wanted to satisfy the fishermen and the economy by producing fish to catch. They have responded as best they can to get a fish to catch. Now we've entered where all these other research projects are going to be asking for more scientific questions on their management, and that insulation down there. This hatchery center that we've got is going to be of interest to every fishery person in Alaska, and British Columbia, Oregon, and Northern California. So that insulation is talking to us in the Willamette Valley here, in the LC Valley, where it's going to bring scientists from all of the country to come in, and they're going to ask. I listened to Whitney Ball today. They're going to ask for help in scientific research to answer some of the questions, because every time they start on the Washougal, they're working for 30 years, they come up with more questions than they do answers. They're interested in production. Here we're interested in research. I'm hoping that we will all join in and working for the best and cope with the rest. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andy. Appreciate your testimony a lot. Please, for the record, though, Andy, could you give your name?
I can't hear with a beam.
I say, could you For the record, could you give us your name in the mic?
Right. My name is Andy Landforce, L-A-N-D-F-O-R-C-E.
Thank you, Andy. Jeff, please.
Chairman Jensen and representatives, my name is Jeff Light, and I am a biologist for Plum Creek Timber Company. And Plum Creek Timber Company owns about 285,000 acres of commercial timberland in the nearby drainage of the Alce and the Siletz, as well as down south in Coos Bay area, all within the heart and soul of the Coastal Coho ESU. And I'm here to say a few words in support of this hatchery research facility that's being constructed. First off, though, I wanted to say thank you for visiting the valley and coming out to the far corners of the kingdom and seeing what it's all about. It's great to kick dirt with you and get muddy shoes together, and that's what it's all about. Plum Creek has been a strong supporter of the Oregon Plan from its inception, and we believe in the plan. We think the plan is because of its cooperative nature and its breadth and depth, that it's probably the best thing going for dealing with a listed species. And so Plum Creek has supported the plan, and also we very much support the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's contributions to that plan. Many other landowners and other land uses and agencies have participated in making the plan a success, but ODFW in particular is in the forefront of, probably because it's a fish species, but they're in the forefront for having contributed the science and the know-how and the expertise to make the plan a success. So we definitely are in support of their contribution. And it's no secret, hatcheries are a worldwide tool used in fisheries management, and as Alan has suggested, you can see the positive benefits it's had on communities and fishermen worldwide by the numbers of fish it's produced. But also you're no doubt well aware of the negative impacts that have been postulated and pronounced by scientists and others that hatcheries can potentially have on wild stocks. So the issue of hatcheries and the role of hatcheries is a worldwide issue. So it makes sense to me that we have a facility like you saw being constructed today in place here and in the hands of both the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon State University, which has a super group of talent there too. So the two of them together, to my eyes, makes sense that they be the leaders in tackling this issue of the role of hatcheries in maintaining and sustaining wild populations. So for those reasons, Plum Creek Timber Company supports the ongoing construction and the maintenance of the facility, and we really look forward to what the products of that facility will make. I also want to say, though, while I'm up here, a word not about the hatchery, but Lindsey Ball talked about the coho viability assessment that they recently released. And I know that comments went to the National Marine Fisheries Service reviewed that. I sent comments to that. I read the coho viability analysis, and for your record, I wanted you to know that I very much believe that is probably the best analysis that you're going to get for viability of a listed stock, and that's principally because you've got the information that has been generated for this area by ODF&W. I think I'd be very surprised to see if the National Marine Fisheries Service could find any better data, and I would also argue that they're going to have a hard time finding a better plan than the Oregon plan to make use of the information and to recover the stocks. So we support the outcome of that analysis, which says we don't think they need to list the coastal coho, and back to my original comment, we believe the hatchery facility is a good idea. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Let me say that we genuinely, in the legislature, or at least some of us genuinely support our appreciate the support that we have received from the private sector in relationship to these activities, because without your support, we would be hard pressed. And so thank you to personally and to your company and to all of the others who have been very willing to step forth with the support, and sometimes with even some pretty hard decisions that they have to make. So thanks. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay, very good. The next group, Bruce Buckmaster, Dr. Ron Johnson, or Anderson, excuse me, and Tom Davis. And while they're coming up, just a comment to Wayne. The pay in the legislature has not increased all that much since your time. And the attitude sometimes by people about the pay is about the same as it was then. Question whether anything they pay us isn't too much. But please, if you would, I don't know whether you or Dr. Anderson want to lead off, Bruce, whichever is.
My name is Bruce Buckmaster from Astoria, Oregon. I'm president of BioOregon, Inc. I'm here with our director of development, Dr. Ron Anderson. Thank you, Chairman Jensen, members, for giving us an opportunity to enthusiastically support the Hatchery Research Center. In 2000, I was asked to serve on a Columbia River Citizens Forum. It was from out your way, Chairman Jensen. It was formed by the Umatilla tribes and the Oregon wheat growers. That group brought together people from timber, ag, water transport, tribal, sport fishing, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, power, the lower river communities, and commercial fishermen together to seek consensus on issues regarding fish. We met for 3 years. We produced one white paper. Maybe that's not unusual for committees, but it seemed like a hard time. But the one white paper that was presented and is available was on hatcheries. The goal for that entire group, which normally you wouldn't see in the same room without a federal judge at one end of it, was that our objective was abundance, and that responsibly managed hatcheries were an essential tool to reach abundance. That in mind, our business, BioOregon, has been around on the coast of Oregon since 1928. It changed radically in the mid-1960s, when the last time the Oregon State University and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, at that time the Fish, Department of Fisheries, got together and worked on science, very hard on science projects. They developed what became the most revolutionary technological development in hatcheries up to that time, and maybe to this day, the Oregon moist pellet. BioOregon began to manufacture that, was the first one to make a pound of it, and I believe was the last one to make a pound of that particular entity. From a commercial point of view, what can come out of a cooperation and a facility like the Hatchery Research Center is what came out of that Oregon moist pellet. I did some calculation last night. Since that time, we have sold approximately $250 million worth of fish feed. Half of that has been to hatcheries outside of the state of Oregon. That is money that has come into Oregon, supported jobs, supported taxes, schools. On March 1st, we were asked, we're given the opportunity to write a letter to Senator Smith and Senator Wyden in support of federal funding for the Hatchery Research Center. We did that, happily did that. I will read one sentence, actually two sentences from that letter. It says, if we hope to solve the regional challenge of endangered fish recovery combined with abundant commercial and sport fishing opportunity, we must quickly add to our knowledge base. Einstein said you cannot solve a problem with the same level of thinking that created it. And with that, I will go to somebody who has a better level of thinking than I do, Dr. Anderson.
Thank you very much. Yeah, my name is Ron Anderson. I'm employed
by Mr. Buckmaster at BioOregon. I'm responsible for business development there. I'm also a practicing fish nutritionist in the sense of our business. I've worked in the industry and at BioOregon for all of my working career, 27 years. So I'd like to begin, Mr. Chairman, by simply saying, as Mr. Buckmaster had said earlier, we're here to support the Hatchery Research Center. I'd like to just give a little bit of history as I've learned salmon culture in my time here in Oregon. All of the fish that were brought into hatcheries originally, you know, when the Oregon programs began 50 or 60 years ago, were wild fish. So wild certainly is not something new. It's where all of these programs had their origin. In the 1960s, the Oregon Fish Commission at that time and Oregon State, as you just heard earlier, cooperated to develop the Oregon pellet. And that truly was absolutely revolutionary and essential to moving hatchery production into a mode that it could actually expand and reliably produce coho, chinook, and other salmon and trout. Without that, and before that point in time, there was a huge struggle with disease and means and mechanisms to feed these fish. This is truly a revolutionary, and it extended to hatchery programs throughout the Northwest as well as the Great Lakes. In the 1970s, at that time it became the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, but the department had a large hatchery biology segment that developed hatchery production technologies and improved fish production efficiencies and smolt survival. Many of those were implemented in Oregon hatcheries and reproduced throughout the Northwest from California to Alaska. During that same time in the 1970s, Oregon scientists and biologists traveled to Russia, to Japan, to Chile, to the Great Lakes regions, providing expertise for programs there and deriving benefits from seeing what people in those areas were doing with salmon. So 35 years ago, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, there's just no question, they were leaders in the science and technology of hatchery production, and their work was absolutely recognized worldwide. The result of that leadership to the state of Oregon was that ultimately Oregon established and operated the large and efficient hatchery program that it has today. And that's been able to mitigate against substantial losses of freshwater habitat from reasons, as we've heard, from hydro to agriculture to logging and others, simply urbanization. That program provided fish in the face of awful ocean conditions during the period of the 1980s and the 1990s. You kind of wonder where things would have been without that hatchery segment at that point in time. Large proportions, maybe as much as 80% of the big Chinook runs that we've experienced recently have come from hatchery production. So Oregon had been a leader. Oregon has built a wonderful program. The Hatchery Research Center, I think, now is an opportunity to renew and advance the science of hatchery biology in Oregon. It seems to me that it's uniquely positioned to benefit from the presence of experienced fishery professionals that are already in this state and in the area. It can benefit from existing and ongoing private businesses that are affiliated to this industry and here in the area. And there's this, as I just tried to point out, a solid history of research and development to fall back on. So, in my experience in working and developing salmon feeds and feeding strategies, the hatchery program is going to benefit as a whole from the Hatchery Research Center. And I just wanted to throw out a couple of maybe research ideas that I see as particularly relevant and could perhaps be considered. And I'll just list them. There's three of them. First, how can nutrition, feed form, and feeding strategies be used to ensure that the hatchery salmon that we produce develop physiologically and morphologically to be nature identical, if you will, to mimic wild salmon. And the critical processes of smoltification, migration, and avoidance of predators. Maybe a simple way of saying that is, you know, wild fish are a wonderful model, and the hatchery can look to wild fish and begin to really establish how we can produce hatchery fish that are nature identical. Second question, and I heard Director Ball refer to this morning in a way. What feeds and management practices are needed to ensure that the effluent that are discharged from Oregon hatcheries does not pollute the streams and the common receiving waters that have to receive that effluent? And the third one is, how can salmon hatcheries be operated so that the sum of all the necessary activities that go on there can be described simply as sustainable? Those are simply areas of my interest from my experience working here in the past 27 years. To conclude, I'd like to throw out just a quick comment regarding, you know, rehabilitation of salmon spawning habitat and how hatcheries perhaps could be involved. Research has shown that returning salmon are important mechanisms to bring nutrients back to inland waterways. Salmon carcasses and surplus salmon returning to hatcheries can be used to rehabilitate that deficit of nutrients. And one of the ways is to adapt processing technology and convert those carcasses to pasteurized and disease-free briquettes or fertilizer cubes, if you will, to utilize in stream rehabilitation to benefit wild fish. That's a project BioOregon has had some involvement with BPA in over the past several years. And I don't think, although it's not directly related to hatchery biology, it's certainly something that bridges the gap between hatchery production and wild fish rehabilitation. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Appreciate your comments and testimony. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Chairman Jensen. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Davis. I'm chairman of the Healthy Watershed Council. For the last 4 or 5 years, as chairman of the council, we've been very active in habitat restoration projects. Finally, we have a director from ODFW or with ODFW who realizes the importance of a facility that the world needs, not just Oregon, the entire world, to avoid some of the dilemmas that have been put upon us through the hatchery versus wild dilemma. We will have the opportunity to study that. This isn't a short-term fix. This is something that takes a lot of years to study. And I would just like to urge that you support this program. You're at your best. We have many, many opportunities here, and it's also important that you support this because we must remain neutral. We can't have agenda science. We have to have science based on fact, peer-reviewed science, good science. And we also have to, as humans, be able to accept the results of that science and not go into this with an answer before we start. So I would urge you to support this on a long-term basis. Grants are wonderful, but grants are short-term. They don't last very long, most of them. And the life cycle of these fish is 3 to 4 years. So it's not anything that we're going to find out overnight. So these are going to be long experiments, and I would urge you to support this HRC. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I think one of the things that will certainly help keep that support coming is the efforts that we see, like yours, and here in the ALSI drainage area, and across the state and others. I mean, the people are the ones who are really going to drive how long the support lasts. And, we obviously need people in future legislatures that are going to be committed to the same goals, and but we trust you a little bit to be the ones who are going to elect those people. So you know, with that, appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Take two this time. We've got Stan Steele and Frank Morris. Let's see what place. Okay, then let's go with Bob Jacobson and Terry Thompson, if you would come up. Please proceed, Stan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stan Steele. I actually grew up on an Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife hatchery at the Lieberg Trout Hatchery. When they opened that hatchery in 1951, I was 1 year old and was raised there with a father who worked for ODFW as a hatchery tech. In 1973, I went to work for the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division and was based in Corvallis, and my home country was the Alsea Valley. Well, as a small Blue River, Lieberg, Oregon kid moving to Alsea, it was actually just heaven over here. It was so much similar in the area that I grew up. And I've always been very, very involved with fisheries. As a matter of fact, my number one hobby is fishing. And since I retired from working for Captain Ball, I actually started my own business. A guide business, and I've become very active statewide in working numerous different rivers from eastern Oregon to western Oregon. And with that business, I have evolved even further in understanding how important wild fish and hatchery fish are to our economy. The Alsea Valley is a valley that has suffered through the loss of tremendous amounts of timber jobs. At one time, the Sayuslaw National Forest led the nation and timber harvest. We still lead the nation in timber growth, but the jobs have left. What was real interesting in 73 when I came here, there were two markets in town, two restaurants in town, a service station, and a thriving Forest Service facility, and business was absolutely good. And things evolved. And obviously we had numerous different influences that caused that evolution. But one thing that remained relatively constant was our fisheries. And with that, of checking hundreds of people a day over Christmas break, which was always the highlight of the steelhead season on the Alsea, was you really saw the connection that Oregonians had with their natural resources. So with sadness, when the fisheries started to decline, we also noticed other things started to decline. Alsea's down to one market. It's down to a sometimes open cafe. The service station, there was two. There's one. In other words, small rural America took a real hit, just an evolution of the economics of Oregon. But one thing that can remain constant is fisheries and its support of local economy, tax dollars for K-12 to higher education. The HRC is something that I am so excited about as a fisherman and as a person who still derives his income from harvesting natural resources is unlimited. We have the opportunity to take the worldwide leadership in anadromous fisheries back into our hands. I think for us not to do that means that we're not really as interested other than just verbalizing our support of natural recovery of wild fish and the interactions hatchery fish can have with those. I see us having a tremendous responsibility to provide an economic boost to rural Oregon. And that is where it's going to have to be, is in Fall Creek. That's where it's going to start. There's a guy sitting right next to me that I met clear back in the early 70s, that these guys were icons in their business. What they did had an influence, and it influenced every one of us takers, us harvesters. And we have that ability to influence Oregon's quality of life now and for future generations, untold future generations. With the recent surge of internet activity. There's qualityfish.net, there's steelhead.net, there's ifish.net. You'd be surprised at the level of intelligence, or lack of sometimes, that's displayed on these breeder boards. But the thing is they're visited by literally thousands of people a day, thousands of Oregonians a day, very interested in our fisheries issues. Now, quickly, I've been to Alaska. I've witnessed Alaska Chinook fishing. It's phenomenal. But I'm taking $3,000 out of Oregon economy every time I fly to Alaska and fish in the Nooshigak River. As Bob knows, and we had as good a fall Chinook fishing on the Alsea River this year as the Nooshigak can ever produce. It was an incredible, incredible fall fishery. With that, those dollars are going to start staying home. We don't have to fly to Dillingham, Alaska, and get in a 1942 sea otter and fly out to catch Chinook salmon. We can do it right here. But how we're going to preserve those fisheries is to be able to answer a lot of questions in our down cycles. Everything's good when it's good. But what does cause? What is the cause of our fisheries to spiral downward? And they spiraled. It was a quick turn. Without the information coming out of the HRC, we're still going to be doing what we've done for the last how many years? Guessing. We estimate this, how many fish are going to come back. Well, how many are going to come back? The ocean is such a big pasture. We really don't know what goes on in there. And I so totally agree with Lindsay. The inland habitat is a project that will never end. So I guess I'll close with how important I think your jobs are and our jobs are out here as harvesters and of concern, and the word I love to use and always have used, is connected citizens, is the future of what our impacts will be through HRC research. Without it, I'm really fearful that we won't see another spiral downward because we're leaving too much to guesses. HRC and the science that come out of there is our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Stan. Next,
Chair. Could I ask one? Or just
you
make
bet.
A statement?
Excuse me.
You know, I moved to Newport in 1972, and I can remember hauling tires over here to Alsea and calling on the loggers and the road builders, and we don't do that anymore because they're not there anymore.
We have two mills in the valley. We had one just located just right here within a half mile of us, and we had another one over in Lobster Valley. They were thriving businesses. There's oftentimes been concern about, well, we're backwoods Oregon. Well, we're really maybe backwoodsy, but we're pretty intelligent also. And so we know about the impact. So thank you. I mean, that shows you the economic impact that has left the valley.
Big time.
Thank you, Representative, for a good comment. Next, we have Bob Jacobson, and for those of you on the panel who don't know Bob, would like to express our thanks to him for the work he did on the task force that we created in the legislature to define recovery. He took that job of as the director or president or whatever it was, the title that would go with the fellow that was responsible for keeping that task force going and keeping it on course. We really need to express our appreciation for the hard work that you did with that. And I know there were times you must have been a little...
I wanted to throw up my hands and go home.
Yeah. But I think as Captain Ball will tell us that it was at least in part the work of that task force that provided the department with part of what they needed to get the report that they have sent to National Marine Fisheries Service to request, in essence, a delisting. So with that, members, my appreciation to Bob and all the work that he's done in support of us in the legislature as well as the industry here that we're talking about. And I realize Representative Dingfelder knows him well. We were both a part of that activity. And with that,
indicate
Bob,
my salary for taking on that job was even less than yours as a legislator.
Did you get any per diem?
Not even per diem for all the meetings we attended. So.
But, Bob, we doubled your salary in the middle of the choice.
You did. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jacobson. I'm a longtime coastal resident, currently reside in Walport, Oregon. I was talking to Lindsey Ball the other day, and he was indicating to me how the people of Oregon had really stepped up when it came to salmon enhancement efforts. You know, I'm pretty darn proud of these people, too, because when salmon stocks reached their all-time record low levels 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, people from all walks of life stood up and said, we're tired of being part of the problem. We want to be part of the solution. With the Oregon Salmon Plan providing the blueprint and state, federal, tribal, and private timber company biologists providing the technical assistance, people from all walks of life jumped onto the salmon restoration bandwagon. The program is working. It has been hugely successful because it was built from the bottom up, starting first by getting the riparian landowners, large and small, on board. What are the benefits that have been derived from this tremendous salmon restoration enhancement effort? Let's use coho as an example, and you heard a couple of previous speakers today talk about coho. I don't think there's a biologist in this room, nor is there one in the state, that would have predicted that we would have seen coho rebound after they did, or after they were at their all-time low 10 years ago, to become the very healthy, robust populations in many coastal streams that we see today. In fact, you heard Director Ball say that we're currently in the process of recommending to the federal government a no-list decision for coho. Well, Alan, certainly good ocean conditions played an extremely important role in this resurgence of coho stocks. Let's don't underestimate the importance of all the in-stream restoration projects like Jim Davis and others have talked about up here. They were very, very important in the past in this success story, and they will continue to be an important component of this in the future. So to all who are involved in the restoration effort, both from putting in a lot of work to providing funds like the legislature and the private timber companies and the federal people, a huge thank you. Your efforts certainly have paid off. You know, hatcheries have been in vogue on the Oregon coast since the first hatchery was created by a guy by the name of R.D. Hume on the Rogue River in the late 1800s. Today, some people think that hatcheries are the panacea for all that ails salmon production in the state. Others feel just as strongly that there's no place for hatcheries, it's a waste of taxpayers' dollars, and that certainly hatcheries interact in a negative way with naturally spawning fish. I'm here today to tell you that, number one, we do need hatcheries to satisfy the current and future demands of recreational, commercial, and tribal fisheries, that salmon of hatchery origin do provide a tremendous economic boost to coastal economies, particularly during the summer months. I'm sure that Representative Brown, who, as I am, is a local businessman in Newport, would back up that statement that when there's no ocean recreational salmon fishery on hatchery-produced coho, businesses in Newport and the entire Oregon coast feel a pinch. I own a small RV park north of Newport, and our production is down, or our income is down to 10 to 15% each year where we don't see a salmon fishery in the ocean. It is that important to the coastal economy, period. It's also important in the fall when those fish return to their native streams to spawn. We've developed, as Stan said, a tremendous in-stream recreational fishery on primarily fall Chinook in the past, and when coho return to the catchable list, and we hope they will, we'll also see a big fishery on coho. 20 years ago, when stocks were way down, we were lucky to see maybe a half dozen boats on a river. And from a very personal standpoint, I go out there today where I used to see a half dozen boats, and I now see 50 or 60 or 70 or 80 or 100. And it's a little bit of concern of mine because I don't have it all to myself. But in terms of economic development for the local area, it's been very, very, very important and will continue to be. Number three, that we need to protect our naturally spawning stocks of salmon. Four, that hatcheries, as we operated them in the past, had some negative impact on naturally spawning salmon stocks. And finally, number five, that the Hatchery Research Center, which you funded last session and visited earlier today, is the single most important salmon-related research development I have seen in the 40-plus years of involvement with salmon issues in this state. Single most important development. For the first time, we'll have a facility where the goal is not maximizing production, but rather is to contribute to the knowledge base on how to minimize the impact of these valuable hatcheries on watersheds and on naturally spawning fish. Oregon, as they did with the development of the Oregon Salmon Plan, will once again be leading the way with an innovative program that will provide a solid foundation and blueprint for future hatchery programs in this state and in the region. Thanks for taking the time out from your busy schedules to visit the HRC today and for your financial commitment to salmon restoration, enhancement, and production in the past, and I would hope well into the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Terry.
Hey, Terry Thompson, former representative from actually just this outside of here, where Lincoln County line, which you were in Lincoln County when you were in Hatchery. I was deciding how I was going to talk about this, and I think I'm going to try to tell you a story about what it was like 55 years ago when I first stepped on a salmon troller with my dad and was fishing off of Newport. Nice weather and small boat. Those days they were real small boats. And my dad standing next to me in the cockpit of a salmon troller and telling me he's going to teach me how to fish salmon. The very first fish that comes up, he reaches over, gaffs it, throws it in the boat, hits it in the head. I see this gorgeous fish laying on the deck and think, well, that's what I'm supposed to do. The second one comes up on the wire and he says, okay, now you get over and do it. I reached over, tried to hit the fish, missed the fish, got about the third whack, stuck to the side of the boat, fourth whack. I finally got the fish, took everything I could to throw it on the deck. And then I hit the fish in the head, and I looked down, and there was another one of these gorgeous fish. And I can remember to this day, and this is a true story, I asked my dad, are we doing the right thing? And his comment was, you want to eat, don't you? And that's kind of where we're at with fisheries management. This state lives on natural resources. Telecommunications is important, but we live on natural resources. Salmon is one of our greatest natural resources we have. And I picture us today about the same as we were in the telecommunications industry when they invented the first computer chip. It revolutionized the industry. With this facility that's built over here, and what I believe will probably happen, but that will depend on the science, but we'll look back 30 years from now and say, this was the invention of the computer chip for the salmon industry. This is going to teach us how to manage streams. This is going to change forest practices. We may find that we can harvest forests in different areas farther down to the river. This is going to teach us what our hatcheries can be done to supplement the runs instead of creating the fat, lazy fish that we have been in the hatcheries. We're going to, hopefully, come out of there with healthier fish. And most of all, it's going to save the taxpayers money. And that's your job. What you've done in spending this money in the long run is going to save millions and millions of dollars. We may produce far less fish in the future out of our hatcheries. But I'll sit here and tell you, I am almost as sure as can be, we're going to get more fish back for less dollars. And that's good for taxpayers. Thank you for being here. And I think it's a huge step we're taking.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate your comments. And if I can make a couple of statements, former Representative Thompson was also one of those individuals when I first went to the legislature that was something of a mentor for me. He was part of the team of people in the legislature who labored over and worked on the Oregon salmon plant. And were it not for his efforts and others like him, we wouldn't be nearly as well off today, I think, as we are.
Can I make a comment? Let me tell you how excited I am to see how far we've gone.
Please.
It's gone beyond anything I could have ever imagined. When we first sat down and started the Oregon Salmon Plan, I mean, we had people telling us it wouldn't work. We had environmental groups that were after us. And Paula Burgess and a team from ODF&W, I had the right of being in the room making the very first draft. And I think it'll probably be one of the highlights of my life when I look back and see all the changes that have been made. I'm just glad to be a part of it.
And as I say, we were fortunate that you were a part of it. And I do have to take this opportunity, Representative, in light of your political affiliations, to point out to my distinguished colleague on my left and one that's been with me through many of the battles and who I accused this morning of being a thorn in my side, she somewhat was chagrined with that statement. And thought that she was the rose by my side. And I then told her that, you know, the old song, roses have thorns. So I did very much appreciate, since you share some political affiliations with the representative, your comments about the need to use our natural resources. That is, of course, so true, at least as far as I am concerned. Oregon is a natural resource state. We may have a lot of other things, and we do, and we're capable of a lot of other things. But fundamentally, bottom line, this is a natural resource state. And as our natural resource industries go, so goes the economy of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I just wanted to say for the record, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Thompson is not the last of his party affiliation that appreciates the value of natural resources in this state or in this country.
I would appreciate
you get out of here.
I just wanted to say one more thing. It really says a lot about Oregon's government that you're an LC Oregon speaking to us. I think you guys are tremendous.
Thank you. It's our privilege to be here. We have Zemini Stout and Garrett Blanchard. Ms. Stout, if you would lead off, please. Appreciate it.
I'm Mimi Stout, and I'm an ALC resident. My husband and I have lived here for 35 years, so I saw things like Stan was talking about, a thriving town when we first moved here, and I see one that's dying now. We own a couple miles of ALC River frontage. And we, in the last few years, in our riverfront land, we've planted 18,000 trees. So we're one of the small contributors to the salmon rehabilitation. I have a little different view. I think you've heard from the fishermen here. But I'm a fish eater, not a fish catcher. And I remember being at a legislative hearing and hearing the Indians say, well, we look at the fish differently than the white man does. We look at the fish as food. And I think being a homemaker, I look at the fish as food also. And I think there's nothing more important than trying to keep a good, healthy food supply for the citizens of our country. And this research facility would seem to me to be a very good step in that direction. The fish is more and more becoming a popular item. I mean, you read all the time, well, you need to eat all this fish to stay healthy. So, you know, you can't eat computer chips. So I think fish is is pretty important. The other thing is that having this facility in our neighborhood here is going to be a big help to the town because, like they said, we've just lost about everything. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments a lot. And I appreciate there are some fish eaters out there for the salmon and others out there. Mr. Blanchard.
I'm Gary Blanchard. I'm a forester, and I'm here representing Starker Forests. Starker Forests owns several thousand acres here in the valley, and as you drove out here, you drove through some of what I take a lot of pride in managing, even some of the clear cuts. I don't know whether those attracted your attention or not, but I would assure you.
Gary? Just for the record, Gary, as we were driving out here today, I was pointing out to my distinguished colleague the beauty of some of these clear cuts, especially as we see the new trees that have been planted and the future generations wood products being replenished from those clear cuts. So, yes, they were talked about on our way out.
Well, I appreciate that, and I don't want to forget to invite you back to the woods. If you have time and if you have interest, we offer tours all the time, and we'd be very pleased to show you how we manage land in this watershed or any others. I'll be fairly brief here. First, I like Mimi's comments. I like to eat fish also. Mr. Brown, your comments about, or your question to Mr. Ball about the sustainability of the fish after, even if the ocean conditions do go down, we've done a number of things. Since 1977, our little company's committed about $100,000 a year to voluntary restoration activities. We've replaced culverts, we've put logs in streams, we've planted things, trees along streams. And, of course, the Forest Practices Act figures in here, too, because we're required to leave standing trees along streams. Now, you know, there's some controversy about how wide those buffers should be, but certainly those trees that are left along the streams are left there for a variety of reasons, but one of them is to add large wood to the streams. So there'll be ongoing more or less natural things that will happen as a result of the management actions that are taken right now. And we think it's very important to manage for fisheries as well as timber. We have a huge stake in what happens out here. If these fish are listed, it's obvious that our company and many others like us will be adversely impacted by that. So it behooves us to do the best we can to manage for the fisheries resource as well as our timber resource. You probably already have, and I'm sure you will hear from people who oppose this research hatchery. Just keep in mind that some of those folks are in the business of controversy, and it's not really in their best interests to answer the questions that need to be asked and answered. You know, if they can keep the pot stirred, if they can continue to criticize and postulate that you know, hell, we're going to hell in a handbasket and all that, then they can get more people to join their organizations and keep them in business. So I would hope that you'll use that as a little bit of a filter when you listen to some of the folks who don't like the research hatchery idea. We, and I'm sure I speak for all the rest of the timber companies, and certainly the Stouts and others who have been very generous to offer their land for tours, and if the Fish and Wildlife Department or the legislature, whoever needs streams or land or anything to move outside of the hatchery a little bit, there are going to be questions that probably can't be resolved at the hatchery. They may need a stream someplace to put a few fish in to see if they do come back under natural conditions. We're here to offer our cooperation and would hope that people would take us up on that. So we do appreciate you coming. We appreciate having the opportunity to tell you this, and I enjoyed the little tour that we had down there at the hatchery. I knew that was going in, but I haven't been up there to look at it, and it looks like it's really going to be a tremendous facility. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. Yeah, it really does look like it will be a tremendous facility, and at least I, for one, am pretty excited about it. I think I'm excited about the fact that we in Oregon are going to be on the cutting edge of some of the most important research that we will have in salmon recovery, and it's really great. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, sir, that I for one really appreciate what the private sector has done and the private timber landowners. If you look at a map of the coastal range, most of it's in private ownership, and this could not have happened without your help and your support, and I applaud you for that effort.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I know other private landowners appreciate that recognition, because we do spend all this money and we hope that there's benefit, but like Tom, I think somebody said, this is a long-term thing, and we really won't know if the trees that we're leaving, the trees we're putting in the streams, the culverts that we're replacing. Well, culverts are pretty easy because, if there are barriers of passage and you replace them in a manner that fish can get through, there's an immediate benefit there. But some of this other stuff is going to take a long time. So
the riparian areas along adjacent to the streams, you're setting aside a lot of land.
That's right.
You still have the obligation of taking care of and paying the taxes on.
And you haven't heard much objection from the landowners about doing that.
Yeah. No. Thank you, sir.
Representative Shoffer. Thank you. I do live in Clackamas County. I live in a little town called Happy Valley, but 85% of my constituents actually live in the city of Portland. It goes up into Portland. And, the story you just told about the private landowner investing their time and money and land into water quality, salmon habitat protection and restoration, and the financial investment, that's the story that needs to be told in Portland and Eugene, because it needs to be told over and over again, and I try to take that message there. And I think you're right, there are those that are genuinely concerned about water quality and salmon, and I think they're here too. They're out in the country, they're in town. But I agree with you, there are those that are in the business of obstruction and prohibition. And to those nice folk, they also come and ask me for more money for education, healthcare, and safety. And where do we get it? We get it out of industry, including wood fiber product industry. And you'll have to forgive me, but those that do want to obstruct and prohibit, in my opinion, they should go a couple days without toilet paper and then come back and talk to me about the wood fiber industry. But I do want to just tell you thank you for your efforts. And we need to tell it not just in LC, we need to tell it in Portland and Eugene as well. And I hope you all are doing that, but I do want to thank the private landowners and the lumber companies for doing all that work. And
the other people that I work with and around and I interact with, they're very generous with inviting people to their land to look at what they do and explain what they do. And we have a program, our little company has a program of, we pay for the school buses for school classes that will come out to our land. Now, we provide a guide, we do explain to people what we're doing, but that's been very well received in the Benton County area, the Corvallis, Philomath area. And we've encouraged other people to do something similar, but just having that money available so the schools don't have to come up with the transportation costs to get the classes out there has worked real well. But I appreciate your view on that, too.
Other comments? Thank you very much again, and my thanks to you also for the industry, private industry support of what we're doing here in relationship to recovery of the salmon.
Thank you.
You truly are good stewards of the land.
Yes.
Thank you. No other one signed up. Is there anyone else who would like to make any comments? With seeing no other agenda items, we are adjourned.